Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Deeper Podcast. It's so good for you all to be here. It is our 30th episode by my count, which is kind of crazy that we've been trucking along like this. But Dan, you're still here. I'm grateful for that. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, glad we're both still here, Austin.
It's awesome. It's so good to do this. I'm really excited for today's talk because today this last week we went over the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, Rakshak and Benny from my childhood. Mm-hmm. Could you just give us a bit of a refresher course?
Yeah, Daniel chapter 3. I know you mentioned this kind of, you know, obviously I'm a Daniel myself, and it has been. We were joking beforehand, but honestly, I've always felt a little bit drawn to the book because of that. And obviously, there's some very famous stories there, Daniel in the lion's den, and this is another one, the fiery furnace. And we went through that, and I think it's just a wonderful story in and of itself. But as far as thinking about how to apply it, there's a lot there, you know, seeing this trial that they're going in, the expression of faith, how God delivers there. But the faith, as we talked about too, not just coming after the deliverance, but even beforehand, and how they trust in the Lord, even if he doesn't save us. We're not going to bow down to your image, Nebuchadnezzar, to this idol here. We're going to continue to trust in the Lord. And so we talked about that. We kind of just had the outline of, you know, Nebuchadnezzar issues this challenge really to the Lord in the building of the idol. And then there's a kind of a contest, as it were. I'm going to throw these guys in the fire. Let's see who can save you. And God does. And then we talked about the confessions that are part of the story as well. So, yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful text. I enjoyed thinking about it personally and also then sharing some thoughts together with the congregation.
Yeah. So one of the things that you said in there was actually a John Calvin quote, and I kind of want to use that as the basis for where we end up going today. Because it was basically something along the lines of, you know, we are modern-day manufactories of idols.
Yeah, factories of idols.
That is a fascinating concept. And I wanted to kind of start with a good understanding of idols. Because when we hear idols, especially in the biblical times, you know, it's a very different, very tangible thing as opposed to like our modern-day, like a music idol or a pop idol or, you know, a very different context, and especially in our American Western context, we don't really understand what idols were. So could you just give us a bit of an explainer on, like, what was an idol actually in, you know, in the ancient Near East?
Yeah, that's a good question, and they were much more tangible. Not that they didn't have intangible idols then either, but they were usually things of wood and stone and material, physical material. But they were meant to be representatives of whatever god that was being worshipped. Sometimes we forget that. You know, it wasn't just this statue of Baal or Ashtoreth or you know, in this case, whatever it was, maybe one of the Babylonian deities. It was representative of that god or goddess. And actually, if you think of the Bible story and even creation, you go back to Genesis 1 and how we're made, and there's a lot of, I think, good theology and thinking that as God's making the world, he's making his temple. And what does he put at the center of that? Human beings who are his image bearers, who are meant to represent him, right? So that's kind of the idea. Even in the Old Testament, we see these other cultures who have these idols. Well, that represents Dagon, as we talked about a few weeks ago. And this is his space here on earth representing this god or goddess. And so these physical representations were very clear in some ways as far as what was going on, and, oh, this is the fertility god or goddess, so, you know, we're going to make sure that we have a nice space for them here so they're pleased, and we're going to offer the sacrifices or do whatever is required. But it was very tangible, like you said. In this case, we don't know. It doesn't explicitly say, did Nebuchadnezzar make an image of himself? Maybe. Did he make a image of one of their gods, maybe his namesake, the Nebu, you know, in that case, perhaps.
A giant chocolate bunny.
Right, yeah, like VeggieTales, and you know, Nezer Chocolate Factory. But and which is, you know, funny, but also a good representation. That was his empire.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
and I, you know, just had this question occur as we were talking, so it might be a little off the cuff, but how does the Ark fit in then? Because the Ark of the Covenant was this thing that was, like, this is where God lives, where the ark is where I am resting. How does that fit in with idols, I guess? What, like, Like, I don't know. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I guess the people didn't really get to see that very much, although they did pull the Ark out occasionally for battles. But it's meant to be kind of the throne,
sure,
as it were, even though there was no visible. Sometimes they had the pillar of cloud and that, but you didn't see someone literally sitting
could
there.
Could that, you know, the pulling out of the Ark during battle almost be them turning, that be an example of idolatry?
Exactly.
There?
And it didn't go well when they did that, of course.
Right, yeah.
So I think that's fair to think about. And we see that. So thinking of the quote we started with, the factories of idols, John Calvin's quote. So there's even a note. You remember the bronze snake
that
Lord had Moses make, Numbers 21? Later on, much, much later, with the kings, we realize, oh, the people turned that into an idol. And I think it's, I can't remember which king, I want to say it's Josiah, destroys it because it had become an idol. So even this very good thing that the Lord had delivered them and pointed them to his deliverance, well, they had turned into something that was not good, an idol.
Yeah.
And that goes to the quote, I believe, that we manufacture idols out of anything,
mm-hmm,
because that's just how we're prone. And as we transition to thinking about now, in our cultures, we usually don't have some tangible, sometimes we do, but
sometimes we do, in some cultures we do, but
right,
you know, I don't have an Asherah pole in my in my backyard.
And because of that, we often say, like, see, I don't have any idols. But it's not that simple.
It's not
right?
that simple. So in modern times, we do a lot of intangible idols, personal idols. Just kind of to kick off this discussion, what are some idols that you've seen in our modern society and in our Western society?
You know, I appreciate Tim Keller's work on, you know, thinking, you know, about idols, and he wrote books connected with this too. And just a couple of kind of quotes or near quotes that he had, you know, an idol's anything that we look at and say, you know, save me, right? Or if we think of something in our lives that we say, you know, without this, I'm really nothing. And you kind of put your identity, you put your hopes in this thing. And there's a lot of stuff that we do that at least to some degree with. So wealth or possessions. Obviously, it was a problem in Jesus' day too, because he names it.
He spoke about that,
specifically, but it's definitely an issue in our Western culture, in a capitalist society. And I think it's very telling that we don't often point the finger there. You know, we have political discourse. We usually point at one party to the other. They're the problem. They're kind of the antichrist, we'll even say. Nobody's pointing at the money very often.
Yeah.
Because I think somewhere in, we know, well, we don't want to mess with that. We like our stuff.
Yeah.
We like our comfortability that comes with that. And it's very easy to say our identity's tied in with our possessions, our money. So that's certainly one I think that we have to acknowledge and be aware of. Status, we've talked about this.
We've talked about that one a lot
before. But that's another big thing, you know, whether that's in my job, having a certain status, whether that's, you know, if you're listening, you're in school, friendships, relationships. I mean, that's, I mean, we literally call it status on social media. You know, what's your relationship status?
Right.
Well,
I think one that I, one of my own personal things that I have to work on constantly is my legacy, you know, what will people say at my funeral about him? Like, I want to make sure that, like, oh man, like, he did a lot of cool stuff. And I know I have to keep constantly catching myself being like, that I'm not living so that people have a great, you know, story to tell about me at my funeral.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what that point is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all identity stuff, right? And, you know, fame, you know, whatever that looks like, we're not all going to be rock stars or superstar athletes, but we still want to be noticed.
Yeah.
Or as you mentioned, you know, even just work in general, like, become an idol for us. That's how we're defined. You know, I am who I am because I am this occupation.
And what's interesting about a lot of these things, whether it's idols of, you know, my legacy or what I do or, you know, all of this stuff, it's not necessarily in and of itself bad, is it? You know, it's, money is not the root of all evil. It is the love of money that is the root of all evil, right? And so I wonder, man, there's so many things that I can think of that, again, on their own, they're not bad. But we then take them and we obsess over them and we give them a priority they do not deserve. So I guess, how do we first recognize if something has taken this priority, you know, this place of an idol? And then how do we practically reassign those priorities and importances so that things can still remain good mm-hmm. and important, but not necessarily in the place of an idol.
Mm-hmm. No, that's an excellent point. The idols, even like we said with the bronze snake, this was something that was good. It pointed mm-hmm. to God's deliverance, but got twisted.
The Ark of the Covenant was sure. where God lived, and they turned it into a battle symbol, mm-hmm. and that twisted it.
Right. So that's good to keep in mind. Right away, the story that comes to mind for me is the conversation Jesus has with that rich young ruler, and he calls him to, at the end, you know, sell all you have and give it to the poor. And he walks away sad because basically, to kind of go back to what Tim Keller kind of quoted about idols, he's like, I can't do that. That would be to give away myself in a way. I would become nothing without that. So if there's something in your life, if you look at your life and you look at what you have, whether it's possessions, whether it's your job, your status, a relationship, and you say, that's going to be taken away, it's probably the thing that you're holding most tightly that is closest to being an idol.
Yeah.
You know, if I say, you know, I can't give up this house, you know, who would I be without that? Or I can't give up this job, who would I be?
Or this role relationship. In my society.
Or this possession or financial status, comfortability, security, citizenship. I mean, you know, all these things. That's probably an identifier that, well, I'm holding this too close.
Really close.
It
yeah.
is taking the place, or at least coming alongside of what God is supposed to be in my life, who he's supposed to be, as far as that's where my identity lies and who he says I am. And that's, I believe, what God says in the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. He's to be that defining relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And idolatry is really bringing in other things and making those the definers. And so that's, you know, just to ask ourselves that question, kind of to do a little check-in, a checklist. You know, we have these wonderful things in our lives. And
what am I most scared of losing?
What is it that, and maybe once you see that, like, am I living in worship of that? You know, where I'm putting all my energy, direction toward this. You know, maybe for some it's just, you know, my vacation time. Or, you know, I mean, I don't know. But I think that's an identifier. And, yeah, taking that second step then of what do I need to do to correct that? Is it removing that thing? Is it just changing my perspective? Because I think that sometimes is at the heart of it.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at this wrong. I mean, I can idolize my spouse, mm-hmm. but that's, like you said, that's a gift, right? To have a marriage relationship like that, but it can still be twisted
right.
if I'm not careful. So maybe it's perspective of, hey, you know, first and foremost comes my mm-hmm. relationship with the Lord and who he is. So I think that gets at hopefully what you're asking
there. That absolutely does, yeah. That does, thank you. And then, so I guess we'll change tacks a bit here, take a beat. So Nebuchadnezzar at one point, you know, he's looking at Rakshak and Beni in the furnace, and he's like, their God is protecting them. And he, so, you know, he calls out, and I can't remember exactly what he says,
testifies.
But basically says, your God is the only God who can do this and the only God who can save this way. Mm-hmm. You know, you are the servants of the Lord Most High, I think was part of it. And that sounds to me awfully like a confession of faith. Like, this is the only, your God is the only God who can do this. Your God is the Most High. What do we do with that? Is mm-hmm. that, you know, is Nebuchadnezzar someone that we might eventually run into in the renewed earth as, you know, a fellow believer? What does that mean? And should, and then I guess a follow-up question, is that even a question that we should ask?
Mm-hmm. We always have a curiosity from the time I remember doing Bible studies and being younger. These kind of stories, like Jesus encounters someone and says, your faith has healed you, and they go. And I remember questions always coming up. You think that person really believed? Were they really saved? And we're just curious naturally about this. And Nebuchadnezzar's one, he's really all over the map. I mean, look at just this chapter. He's like, oh, I'm going to set up this 90-foot-high statue. And then at the end, he's saying, no other God can rescue this way, like the God of Israel. And this is not the only instance where he has
that. He does that a few different times.
Yeah. And so I think, and we just this morning with our men's group, we're talking about the character of Melchizedek. We were doing Hebrew study. And I think it relates to this in that as we look at what God is revealing to us, that piece is not as important, whether Nebuchadnezzar was a true believer or not, because that's God's business at the end of the day. Mm. That's not as important as what the Lord is showing and teaching to us through this. So
sure.
We said a little bit on Sunday that we have to identify with Nebuchadnezzar as well as with Rack, Shack, and Benny.
Right.
In that Nebuchadnezzar's wild swings are evident in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And how we one day are just on fire for the Lord and right there with him, and the next, or sometimes in the same day, the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And or as James writes, you know, out of the same mouth comes blessings and curses. And that's really true of, and so just to say, oh, this is who we are in our human nature, and to see how God can redeem broken us, how he can even draw someone like Nebuchadnezzar to that kind of confession. And yeah, we don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know. You know, chapter 4 is another interesting. Nebuchadnezzar goes off. He turns into a beast because he proclaims himself a god. And,
yeah.
And yet he has this confession in that chapter too that, you know, that starts it out kind of like, oh, yeah, the Lord's the one true God. And so we wonder. We wonder about him. We wonder about other characters in Scripture. And where does that go? And we don't know. So I think to answer your second piece is we shouldn't spend too much time wondering. Nebuchadnezzar could very well be there. Maybe if he was in Hebrews 11 or something, we'd have a further indication if he was in the Hall of Faith. But there's some surprising people there from our standpoint as well. So I certainly know that's in the Lord's hands and know, you know, he can save by his grace whoever he wants.
And that, I'm assuming that then translates outside of just, you know, characters we read about in Scripture, but modern day people and leaders. And, you know, there's this politician, that politician, this celebrity, that celebrity. They'll say these things about Jesus. We don't know because we don't know how well their life, you know, we don't know that relationship. So again, is that something that's that we shouldn't really be worried too much about and leave that in just God's hands?
Yeah, I think that's in general good wisdom, you know, good advice, because we don't know. People say things, you know, not even on faith, but just in general things in the media. We don't know them. They give a persona. Perhaps it's true, especially when people profess faith. We want it to be true as Christians, especially if they're leaders, you know, up there as examples for others. But we don't know.
Mm.
And even in our close relationships, of course, we know a lot more, but we don't know all the ins and outs. And we certainly don't know, you know, often at the end of people's lives, where they're at, what they're professing or not professing. And so I think in general, you know, we like to make statements sometimes because we want someone to espouse the same things that we do. But in general, you know, we can hear what people say. We can say we appreciate, oh, this person talked about Christ. That's awesome, you know, and that is great to hear. And but we don't know what their walk looks like. And it's not for us to make that, certainly that final call. That's in the Lord's hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I just figured that's an important reminder for me and for a lot of people. We sometimes put a lot of you know, energy into thinking, man, this person, like, they seem so, like, I'm going to dive in and in some ways idolize often. Because, like, this person's doing great things. They seem saved by what they said. So that means they're saved, so I can follow what they do. That's not always the case.
Yeah, that's a really good connection. You just made it. I don't know if you knew you were doing that or not, too, our first question. But, you know, idolizing even people of faith then. You know, and we have to be careful, even with our wonderful mentors.
Yes.
And pastors. Well,
and it's... And it's the cult of celebrity in a lot of churches right now. And, you know, I could list 15 different megachurch pastors off the top of my head right now. And it's, you know, it's very possible that they're doing great things for Jesus. And it's very possible that we or, you know, people in those congregations or anyone is that actually I'm going to trust this preacher and this person more than I'll trust God.
Sure. Well, and you see what happened to Nebuchadnezzar and his power. Even though in chapter 2 he sees the power of God as Daniel interprets his dream, and he says it there too. But right away, the power thing messes with us, and he's like, you know what I'm going to do? Let's build a massive statue, you know, and I want everybody to come here and bow down.
Yeah,
and we don't do it maybe that grotesquely.
We're really subtle about it, I think. But
yeah, or sometimes from the outside, it's not as subtle. You're like, everybody's got to kowtow to your will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll write that in even the bylaws. Sometimes even of churches, like, you can't be on the leadership team unless you get down with my vision as a senior pastor.
Right.
And, well, what is that if not, you need to come before this statue and bow here, right? There's danger.
Yeah.
And so we have to be careful as leaders, because it's very easy for us to start idolizing ourselves, but also as believers in the church to not idolize our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's a great reminder. Thank you for that. Was there anything else in the text you wanted to chat about or explain but didn't necessarily have the time or the focus wasn't there?
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot in this text. We think we went into some of the idol culture things. You know, there's lots of questions. Was that Jesus in the fire? Mm-hmm. And we actually talked about that this morning in our men's group as well. It doesn't really matter if that was an angel or some sort of pre-incarnation Jesus, you know, and that, because either way, the representation is that was God with them in the fire. And we don't think maybe that way of, like, if I send Austin as my representative, I'm really going.
Mm-hmm.
We don't function that way. We don't have people that would do that for us.
Or at least not on the personal level, but I almost wonder if we do, you know, we've got ambassadors. And so, you know, as our nation, we'll send someone and, you know, that person's representing the United States to Japan to Uganda.
Yep. Yeah. And speaking for,
you
know, the leadership in that case. So,
and representing, I am America in this case. I am representing God in this case.
Right. So when Nebuchadnezzar says this one looks like a son of the gods, he's acknowledging this is not just a normal person in there.
Right.
It could be an angel. It could be pre-incarnate Christ that we don't know for sure.
But that's God's not a there. And that's not a question that we even need to be asking.
Right, because we know God's there, and that's the application.
Yep.
And we talked about that, I know, but you know, if you're listening again, just that reminder of the visual there, which is so powerful, that God goes with his people into the midst of the trials, into the midst of the floods and the fires, makes that promise in Isaiah 43, the flames will not set you ablaze. I thought of Revelation 20 as well toward the end where, you know, the second death will not harm, right? The lake of fire will not harm God's children. And I think you see a picture of that. They could have very well died there, but ultimately, eternally, God's people don't get destroyed that way or don't get separated from him that way. So that's a powerful message. But yeah, there's some curiosity about the fourth one in the fire, of course.
Mm-hmm. I know you're not giving the sermon this upcoming week. That's Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not here right now to answer what he's going to talk about. So, you know, this is all speculation. But do you have any idea what direction he might go and what text he's reading from?
Yes. At least I know the text. They know where exactly he'll go. We'll have to see. But he's going to be in Jeremiah 31, primarily verses 31 to 34, which are famous verses, verses that talk about this new covenant and how God's going to write his law on his people's hearts, and they're all going to know me from the least to the greatest. It's powerful words. It's actually quoted in Hebrews chapter 8 at length there. I think it's the longest quote in all of the New Testament from the Old. But just important, important verses. So as we're thinking about redemption storyline, you know, how does this point us forward to Christ? And I'm sure he might tie in some with the Hebrews, because saying how, oh yeah, God was always pointing to something greater that was to come, something that would be lasting, the work of Jesus that would truly redeem us and truly save us. And so, yeah, it'd be a good message, I'm sure, and looking forward to seeing where Tim takes it as well.
Yeah, that'll be very good. Well, thank you so much, Dan, once again, for coming here and talking and sharing your thoughts. Thank you to everyone who's been listening. As always, it's just a joy to do this. It's a joy to be here with you and to worship and to learn more. You know, I worship through the intellectual pursuit of knowing new things. So this is always a fun opportunity for me. Go with peace, everyone, and we will see you next week.